Dr. Adrian, my friend. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Are you back full-time in Austin? I see, I get nostalgic looking at your stories. It's just like a lot of Barton Springs. I see a lot of like nearby trails that look super familiar. Are you back there like full-time?
Yes, yes. I live right next to Barton Springs, like down the street from Barton Springs on the Greenbelt. I was planning on moving back here before my son started middle school, and he starts middle school in a couple of weeks.
Nice. Yeah, it's awesome. I have just a lot of fond memories and only nice things to say about it. You weren't living there when I was living there, right?
No, no. So when you were there, I was a little bit outside of the city. And that was mainly because I was trying, I didn't want to be, it's just crowded in the city.
For sure, for sure.
And then also school district wise, for where my son goes to school, it was, I was just trying to work out, you know, the right place to go. So he's zoned to really good schools here, like best school in the school districts in the state. So that's why I moved, is like I was scoping out like where I could move, where school district wise would be good, and then I could enjoy the city but also not feel super crowded, because I'm not a city, like I don't like living in the middle of a big city. And I know not Austin's not like, you know, New York or anything like that, but I have mostly lived in the outskirts, like just for my own preference of like I don't like to be around so many people all the time and traffic and all of that, but I'm getting used to it.
Yeah. I'm with that as well. We've lived in, man, I don't know, four or five different places in my 20s and beyond. And each time we like pick a city and we're like, I want to go just outside the city. I want to go just outside. I want to have access to it, but I'm not necessarily like a drop a pin, drop me right in the middle of Main Street and I'll be happiest. But I think Austin has a bit of like the best of several worlds, right? I mean, they have a decent, like a good green belt. There's like good parks and honestly, good trails nearby, which I feel like people don't necessarily know unless you're from there. So I think it has a good, you know, if you want a city vibe, you can find it. If you want it more chill vibe, you want a little bit more greenery, let's say, I think you can find it too. So yeah, high praise for Austin.
That's why I lived here. That's why I moved here. It's like what you said, I know all the local spots. So I'm like, I live on the green belt. I'm in there every day. Like I'm on the trails in all over the place, in all the natural areas around here.
Is it Barcade? What's that? The arcade bar place.
Cybercade.
My buddy lives on the whatever that high rise is, like right next to like the one that's like literally right next to it. So
yeah.
Smack dab in the middle. On your son picking a school. My daughter's one and a half, you know, we're not like, you know, doing that just yet, but what's that process look like? What are the things that you're considering when making that decision?
I mean, for me, it was just academic, like, standards, like what I was trying to get him into, cause he's, you know, he's always done very well, like academically. He's never got like through fifth grade. I think his lowest grade is like 95. They tried to move him up a grade in one of his other schools, and I was like, we're just going to go to a different school district where it's going to be more competitive and more academically challenging. So that's been my like key, is just trying to get him into a place where the resources and you know, environment is there for him to be more academically challenged than he has been, because we've been in different districts, and especially in Texas. I don't know if it's like that in other states, which I'm sure it is, but it's a massive difference, like one district to another. You know, the funding is substantially different. Like we're on the west side of Austin, where it is, there's a lot of funding in the school district due to property taxes, and they have a lot of resources. It's nice.
How does that manifest for the child? Do you feel like in which ways do you find most important?
Resources, but also
resources like what?
The different activities that they have available at the school, they have, you know, when they have a talent show, it's just well produced. When they do, you know, the everything, they just have a lot more money in their PTA. Like they raised like $400K or something last year for the PTA. So like all of the, you know, community events are just over the top. Families are involved. You know, it's a different, overall, it's, you know, going to be different types of students because their parents have different standards on them as well. Because a lot of people who go to these schools, like they're also pushing, you know, their kids to do well academically. And so there's just a different baseline. And I think the ways that it manifested, you know, the education is great, but in my opinion, I've seen it in other ways of like his interactions with his peers, like they are all pretty athletic, you know, really intel, like they're all involved in lots of different things. and they are, mostly pretty intelligent. Like it's a different population of students than what he's been around before, and he's a competitive kid. So like, he got there and he's like, "Oh, this kid's so smart, and this kid's so smart." And he started playing chess, started learning Spanish, and this was all on him of like, "This is what the other kids are doing," which is, previously was more, all the other kids are playing Fortnite. And so it's just a little bit of a different, what you surround, your kids with. And that part I did not expect. I was just like, oh, it's a good school academically. And seeing that, like, because, I take him and his friends and do things, and I'm like, man, all of his friends are just smart, well-mannered, and just also athletic, like pretty much all of them. And I'm like, man, that's it's just a different baseline is what I said. Like the expectations are higher generally, I feel like, and that bleeds into what you see and what you expect and what you expect of yourself, I feel like.
Yeah, my parents, we moved out of the city into to New Jersey, and Bergen County is just like a really, really wealthy county in New Jersey, and we didn't really have that much money. My parents have very modest jobs, and their choice was kind of, hey, we're either going to be, I'm going to put it this way, they would not, and I probably would not, but in this sort of a crude way of like, we could be the poorest kid in the rich town, or we can be more along the lines of the median in another place. And they fought really hard to put me into a public school, or get me into a district where the public school was really, really good. And I always say I would have finished at the 50% of my class, no matter what school I was in, as like a baseline of my personality of like, try just hard enough to get by. And I just appreciate that that happened at a place that was slightly more competitive. And so it pushed me, like, I'm sure that that's kind of, push has a weird connotation to it, but it normalized some more healthy behaviors, I think, that ended up proving fruitful. So I also appreciate
Yeah,
that. So, yeah.
normalizes studying. Like, I didn't study in high school. I went to not good schools at all, and I never had to study. I was still like top of my class. Like, it was very, I didn't have to try. And I was like, I want him to have to put in that effort and be in a more competitive environment. This is definitely it. So I'm glad to hear that experience from you about that, because definitely the same situation of like, he is the poorest kid in the school for the most part. I'm sure there are other kids, but like I found the district zoning, and I was like, okay, where can we live that would make sense? And also, like, we're on the green belt, so I was like, this is perfect. Like, on the green belt, close to downtown, good school districts. I can't complain.
That's awesome. Good job, Dad. We talked about this before on the podcast, so I just want to very briefly, because I always find it to be an interesting topic of, okay, so I don't want to go too deep into it. We've talked about it. Your son's a vegetarian slash vegan still.
Yes, vegetarian, not vegan. He'll eat eggs and dairy.
And since we last spoke was a year ago, maybe, about this topic, anything changed as he gets older? Not that I'm suggesting things need to change, but people get older, they change their beliefs on things, they evolve their beliefs on things. Maybe you evolve your style of making sure he's getting all the nutrients that he needs, and maybe just like you learn and you get better at, you're the provider, so you're cooking a lot, you're doing some food shopping, he's obviously making decisions, but has anything changed over the last year or two?
No, I mean he's paying more attention to like his own choices, I think, a little bit more. He's 11, about to be 12, and now he like asked me how much protein is in certain things because he knows that that's important. We talk about the things that matter from a nutrition standpoint for him. Like, vegetarians need to pay more attention to these things because he's gonna have to feed himself at some point. Like you said, I manage it now, but he's gonna have to feed himself at some point. So I want him to understand, how to do that in a healthy way. But I highly doubt that he is ever going to eat an animal product in his life unless it's like lab grown, because he wouldn't. It just harming an animal would he wouldn't do it. Maybe a fish. I think that might, like, he might be willing to do that at some point, but like chicken, cow, like, no way. Pig, there's no way he could bring himself to eat, an animal like that.
Yeah, with you at the helm, he's obviously in really good hands there. And the more, not that, I mean, I say the more I learn about, but this is per the last like 5 to 10 years, the more we learn about like the lack of importance from just obsession with complete proteins and eating, not just complete proteins in isolation, but getting every essential amino acid at every meal. And we're kind of real, and the just amount of protein required to get the muscle building benefits and the knock-on health benefits is just feels like it's a lower bar than one might think coming from like more of a fitness bro background, that like the it's not as hard as you think. I'm not saying it's not doesn't take more intent, but it feels like, hey, he's gonna be all right. You know, he's not gonna like miss out on, you know, muscle. You know, I just posted today about some lady who I think you even commented on it, who's like, I eat 200, 300 grams of proteins per day. And she's like, again, I'm not an ad hominem, like she's not muscular at all. So it just goes to show that, okay, from a, if you want the, like eating protein, yeah, it has more benefits than just building muscle. But from the muscle building perspective, we just hone in on that context, like training's way more important than, you know, how much protein you're eating once you're at a certain point, let's say.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, he's my son's been, I mean, he doesn't lift all that. He's not like going 2 days a week or 3 days a week or anything like that with me. But we have, you know, a gym here, and he goes once a week, sometimes twice. And then he wants to do like a little full body lift. And then he's always doing like, you know, we go to the trampoline park. He's doing the little Ninja Warrior stuff and pull-ups and all sorts of different resistance training. So like, he tells me the other, he's like, Dad, I'm stronger than like all of my friends. And I'm like, because you've been lifting weights, like you actually lift weights at 11 years old. Like no one really does that. And that, like, he doesn't eat meat. Like the meat wasn't the factor. It's and like you said, the you can get you can meet your protein needs on much lower. Even, I mean, for kids don't need that much protein anyway. And so like, you know, he needs 50 grams a day. That's really easy to get, you know, 50 grams max. And so that's you know, in terms of like plant-based dieting and all of that, I do think that there was too strong of a push in the other direction. But in the early, like, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but like early 2013s, you know, 2010s to 2015, it was super, you know, the dominant messaging was around plant-based diets, and you know, meat was harmful to your health. And I feel like for the last 10 years, it took a swing in the other direction of like carnivore, animal protein is necessary at every meal. And that's just how the fads work. The science has been the same the whole time. You know, there's never been, if you're talking to scientists, that, you know, no one would have ever changed their, you know, opinion on any of these things. There hasn't been any like groundbreaking science that has come out that has changed the way that we think about it, besides like we now understand it, you can actually do perfectly fine off plant protein in terms of muscle building, as long as you're eating like 1.6 grams per you know, kilogram, or 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight. You should be fine in terms of like muscle growth.
Agreed. Let's do a soft pivot to today's topic. And we were speaking on air before, and I was trying to think of giving you this speech of, so we're going to, for the listener, we're going to talk a bit about current state of affairs, public health wise. And I was trying to give you this speech of like, hey dude, like I don't want this to be like outrage porn where we're just like whining and bitching about X, Y, and Z, and just, but then we both kind of paused and we're like, well, we kind of have to talk about what's going on. You know, we have to like be honest about things that are going on. So at some point in this discussion, we will try and steel man opposing positions and try and, I mean, I almost like I give goosebumps kind of when I say that. I'm like, I'm not really sure how we can steel man some of these decisions that are being made. But I want us to be just, and I know you will do this, so I'm just reiterating maybe even for just myself, of just want to talk about, honestly, about what's going on in the facts. And then we'll do it, of course, a discussion of, you know, if you were appointed a dictator, right? Things we might do, both realistic and maybe unrealistic, or very least things that people can focus on, or what we would hope, you know, public health initiatives would focus on instead. And I was like, you know, I really don't want to, I was just thinking about it before we hopped on. I was like, I really don't want it to be like a doom and gloom podcast, but I also want it to be real. And so if we are just talking about things that are going on and it gets passionate in some way or another, like, I just think that is what it is. And so, yeah, let's, you know, if there was ever a, hey, let's not take it any further than the facts and our beliefs, but that's what you were, and we were going to do anyway. So let's start with just a bit of a rundown of some of the big rock public health decisions that have been made, you know, in the past 6, 7 months.
So I think the big three that come to mind for me when I hear about like what's going on public health wise, number one, the cuts to Medicaid and Medicare. Like there's going to be pretty large cuts to our healthcare safety nets in this country. There's a lot of people who rely on these things, 15 million, over 15 million Americans who rely on these services for healthcare are no longer going to have access to that. So we're looking at 15 more, million more Americans who are going to have any type of health insurance and are going to rely on emergency rooms, going to rely on basically just not going to get care until it's too late. And then it's even more costly because they go into emergency room over and over again and, rack up all these costs that they can't pay for. And so that's one of the big three. Number two is the we've seen like this current budget bill has the biggest cuts to food assistance programs in the history of this country. And so millions of people, I think it's like close to 20 million people are going to be going to lose access to food assistance. Like close to 10 million children are going to lose access to food assistance. And this means that people who rely on, and it's, a lot of people think, oh, they're getting all of this money and they're going to Costco and buying steaks. This isn't what's happening at all. So I want to address that first, because I know some people may be listening to this and thinking, oh, well, they're just giving out food stamps to people to go, buy, extravagant things. That's not what's happening. And also I hear they're giving out food stamps and people are buying unhealthy food. When you look at food stamp, those expenditures, it's in line with what people who are not on food stamps are spending money on. They're buying the same types of foods as the general population, but lots and lots, millions and millions of people, tens of millions of people are going to lose food assistance. And when you talk about the steel man discussion about both of these, what a lot of people will say is, oh, it's people who are able-bodied and they're not working and they're receiving assistance for these reasons or whatever. When it comes to both of these, there are many circumstances where people are older individuals, and this is the people who are going to get impacted the most from the Medicaid cuts, or the Medicare cuts are going to be the people who are, or the Medicaid cuts are going to be the people who are in their 50s, are not eligible for Medicare, and they're not 65 yet, and they maybe can't work full time for whatever reason. They don't have full-time employment, or they're, mildly unemployed, or maybe fully unemployed, because of various reasons. Maybe they're living with family members and just barely getting by, and they're relying on this for healthcare. And those are the types of people that are generally going to get kicked off of some of these programs. And it's that, and then also there's many people who, for whatever reason, like, someone had, learning disabilities, and so they may struggle with full-time employment, and those individuals sometimes rely on some of these assistance programs. In reality, it's the most vulnerable people in our country. That's what these assistance programs are for. Now, there's a lot of people who are going to say, oh, there's a lot of fraud in these programs, and that's why they're going after the fraud. That's not really the case. Like, the amount of fraud in both of these programs is very low. It's like less than 1%. And the fraud that does occur isn't individuals. It's large organizations that are defrauding these companies. It's or these services. It's not individuals. Like, most of the fraud that's occurring, especially in the healthcare space, is just large medical networks overcharging the government and things like that. And that needs to be cracked down on more so than trying to push people out of having access to healthcare. And so those are some of the, kind of two main things. And then some of the arguments against it is like, oh, it's people that are just lazy and they're just taking money from the government. And that's just not the case. There's if you actually, have exposure to, these individuals who are using these services, there's a wide variety of different people who end up on these things for a wide variety of different reasons. And just as a society saying that we're just not gonna, provide these safety nets, and that's what taxes are for. That's the purpose of collecting taxes as a society, is to take care of our population. So we've cut all of, all significant amounts of funding from those programs. And just a quick note, and I know we're mostly talking about healthcare, but all of that money is going towards the military and ICE, like all of it, like all of the money that's being cut from social services that help provide healthcare and food to the most vulnerable people in our population, is that tax money is being allocated instead to strength, quote unquote, strengthening our military, which we already spend significantly more than anybody else in the whole world by far. Which really, strengthening our military means giving contracts to large defense, defense contractors, like these massive companies get these billion-dollar contracts from the government, and when we spend more on military, they get more money, and they have lobbyists that are making sure that we continue to spend more on military, and that budget never goes down for whatever reason. And then the other side, the ice expenditures, there's $150 billion on ice, ice funding for detention facilities and armored equipment, and this makes ICE now the highest funded military organization essentially in the United States. Like, it has more funding than the other military or the other branches of the military at this point. So now we have, all of the money getting taken, or taxpayer money getting taken away from these services, going towards, these other things that, if you agree with that, fine. But I personally don't, and I think most people don't, wouldn't be okay with, paying taxes to make sure that it's going, for it to go in that direction. The other thing, the other massive cut that is going to have a huge negative impact on health, and this one's going to take more time, but 40% of the National Institutes of Health budget was cut in this new budget bill. And that means that, NIH is, that's what the National Institutes of Health is. It's NIH. It's the biggest medical research, organization in the world, like by far. Like 50% probably of all medical research in the entire world is done in the United States through this organization. And this is how we recruit some of the smartest people in the world to the United States. This is one of the things that drives our economy, is all of the research that comes out of this and how it helps to create new technologies. It helps to create new medical devices, new therapies. All of the information, everything that I've ever learned about nutrition came from NIH research. Everything that we know about nutrition came from NIH research. All of this is funded by the federal government. It normally has about a $40 billion budget. That's being cut by 40%, which means that there will not be any new research in the United States. You hear 40%, you're like, okay, well, there's still 60% of the budget. That is only going to make sure to finish carrying out existing projects and maintain some of the research labs that exist in the United States. A large percentage of the research labs that are established in universities throughout the United States are going to get shut down once this funding goes into place, and no new research, like very little new research, is going to come out of the United States at all. Like, there will not be new cancer research, new heart disease research, new research on nutrition, new research on pretty much any topic, because that cut, that is, leaves enough funds only to carry out existing projects essentially. And so that's, we won't see the consequences of that in, year one or two or maybe even five, but 10, 15, 20 years down the line, the United States is just going to be not, we're not going to have data on our population. We're not going to have a lot of the information that we use to provide evidence for healthcare and nutrition. Is just, that's going to be stagnant. Now, we have good research at this point, but all of the, we're going to be relying on other countries to conduct any future research, because that's not going to be happening in the United States for quite some time.
Yeah, let's do just on the NIH research. There's somebody who's had a, I guess personal is overstated, but Kevin Hall's research on is irony of like where we are, and one of our biggest problems is that we overeat and don't fully understand ultra processed foods. And you have Kevin Hall is like one of the world's, if not the world leader on researching ultra processed foods, who has resigned due to yeah, not
Censorship.
yeah, censorship, right? Not
Yeah, that
being able
was due
to,
to censorship too. That's the worst part about it. It's one thing to cut 40% of the scientific budget. It's quite another thing to tell scientists that they can't study certain things. And so a lot of scientists are leaving because of that reason. And that's, non-budget related, but there is a list of words. If you study diet diversity, if
Women.
you study the impact of dietary diversity on the diversity of the microbiome, because you're using the word diversity in your research grants, you will never get funding again. Like, if you are putting these key words that this administration doesn't want to see in your research grants, you get flagged in your research, is you're not going to get funded. It's so unfortunate. Like, researchers lost grants for this very reason, because they had keywords that got flagged. They pulled grants, and the grants had no relation to what these keywords were actually trying to identify. Like, they were looking for grants on actual, like, looking at diversity and if it's, that's good for the university or stuff like that. Like, they're looking for those type of grants to pull because they don't want studies to be done on that. And they're pulling studies on the diversity of, wingtip butterflies in South America or whatever, and how that impacts, the ecosystem. Like, studies going on like that that have these keywords are getting pulled just from a censorship
I mean,
standpoint,
if
which
you, I don't
is.
know if you've, I mean, I'm sure you have, but for the listener, like, if you've scrolled through this list, it's like 200 different terms that may trigger like a review of your grant proposal. It's like, it's fucking terrifying, right? Like, breastfeed is a word that will trigger. Like you said, diversity will trigger, equality will trigger, female will trigger. Gender will trigger, inequality, injustice, mental health will trigger, non-binary, oppression, like polarization, pollution is a trigger. Privilege is a trigger, pronoun is a trigger, race is a trigger. I mean, sex is a trigger. Like, what are we doing? I mean, I don't want to get, again, I don't want to, I don't, it's so easy for me to be outraged. And the entire time you were doing that monologue, which is incredible, by the way, my palms are soaking wet. Palms are just sweating like crazy, trying to, like, if, and I don't want to be reductionist, and I'd love to try and summarize a bit of what you said and see if, again, you throw it back to me again with a bit more context. But when we're looking at cuts to Medicaid, cuts to nutrition assistance programs, we're, the idea being for those two things at least, that people are abusing the system, that these are freeloaders that are getting handouts. And, if that was money going back into a taxpayer's pocket, that might be, I still have a million issues with that. But like, somebody might be like, okay, like, if somebody could be convinced that there are a bunch of a high percentage of people on these programs, capitalizing on these programs, abusing these programs, and they don't deserve that, and I'd rather have it in my pocket. But that's not actually what's going on. That money is being rerouted to other things like military spending, like ICE, like cuts for the ultra rich, tax breaks for the ultra rich. And so, it is that the line of thinking that, or the pretense that somebody might be under of like, hey, this is, we're getting the freeloaders off these programs, and that money's coming back in my pocket. When in reality, the percentage of people that are abusing this system that may not need it, which by the way is kind of nebulous, who is to say exactly who that person is? I'm sure that there's a percentage of that that does exist, but to gut them essentially, or to have such a large cut is certainly not honing in on a small percentage of those people doing it. It's like wiping out a whole bunch of other people that are actually should qualify for that. And that money's not going back in taxpayer pocket. It's now being rerouted elsewhere. And so you're not just saying in my pocket's better than giving it to these freeloaders. You're literally saying instead of these people having it, it's better that it goes to the military and ICE and stuff like that. Do I have that somewhat correct?
That's pretty much what's going on right now. And aside from that, when you talk about like, yes, food assistance programs, we think about that and you're like, oh, well, you're just paying money to people who, don't have money for food or whatever. But these food assistance programs also support local farms and agriculture in the United States. Like, these programs are set up to like support farms and provide assistance for our population. Like, they're set up in a pretty positive way in many cases. Like, there's one program that they cut $1 billion from this program that buys money from local farms and distributes it to schools and food banks. Like, this makes no sense. Like, now all of these farms in the last 6 months, there's been more farms that have gone bankrupt than any other time in modern history, over the last 6 months, because of these food assistance cuts, because of these USAID cuts, and because of these food assistance cuts. These farmers w who were growing and providing food for these various programs now lost large contracts that their farms relied on, and they're going bankrupt immediately. And it's another side note, but our vice president is someone who is an early investor in a company that buys up farmland in the United States. They consolidate investment funds and they're buying up farmland in the United States. So this is extremely beneficial from a financial standpoint if you are someone who owns a company or is affiliated with a company that's buying up farmland from farmers who went bankrupt. And that's another, not necessarily health related, but extremely shady stuff going on behind the scenes. And when I first saw these cuts, I saw this discussion, had this discussion before, like, farmers are going to go bankrupt. I saw many farmers saying, hey, we lost all these contracts. 6 months later, the data is in now, and it's unfortunate. It's not just impacting the people who people want to label as freeloaders. It's impacting, in this case, with the food assistance, it's the farmers and the people who grow food. But with healthcare, it's also the healthcare system. So there's going to be a lot of rural clinics and hospitals that are going to completely shut down because 20 to 30% of their revenue comes from Medicaid, and if they're not getting that anymore, they can't stay open. And so these hospitals are now going to shut down, and people who had to drive 20 miles to get to the nearest hospital before is now going to have to drive 60 miles. And they may have, before their nearest endocrinologist was maybe 30 miles, now maybe 100 miles. And this is mainly going to impact people who live in rural areas outside of cities, and this is going to impact people all throughout the country. There's going to be hospital and clinic closures over the next couple of years. There's already been several. This is going to continue to occur, and beyond that, healthcare is likely, like, it's going to be more difficult to access because of these closures, and it's also likely going to go up in cost because of the increased demand with the or the same demand with lower supply, and also people who aren't getting the government assistance aren't going to be paying their bills. And so that's going to cause the hospital and clinic systems to have to increase the rates for everyone.
Is it easy to put all of these decisions under the umbrella of, well, we're shaking it up. What was working before wasn't working. These things weren't working. We weren't healthy. We were becoming less healthy over time. Is it easy to lump a bit of that and say, let's say I'm an uninformed person and I'm thinking, maybe I must. It wasn't working. We were getting less healthy. Chronic disease rates are going up, and part of that's slightly not true, but parts of that are not true. But I guess what we were doing is not working. So all right, let's shake it up. Is it easy to make that argument? Do you feel like that sort of rhetoric is coming through?
I mean, if you don't think critically, then maybe that type of logic may come through. But shake things up in which way? What isn't working? First, I mean, if your car isn't working, you don't just start hitting it with a sledgehammer. You figure out what's not working, and then you fix the problem. And we have public health researchers who have been talking about what's not working and the problems that we can address from a government policy standpoint for decades. Like th this is, I mean, so my nutrition degree was public health focused. Most people don't get a degree that has this type of focus. It's more, metabolism or looking at, more of like cellular type of processes. And ours was more translational public health focused. And so we got a lot more exposure in my PhD to these topics. But there's been people fighting and lobbying and conducting research for public health initiatives to improve the health of our population. And many have shown positive improvements. They just need to be implemented on a wider scale. But there's limitations to implementation of these things because food companies don't want that. Like, for example, I think the legislation, or it wasn't even the legislation, it was like an agreement that the government made with food companies. It was like 2009 or 11 or something like that, a long time ago, where they agreed that they were going to stop marketing unhealthy foods to children, because there was a big push during that time against, marketing unhealthy foods to children. There was several researchers who were like lobbying really hard. They were in Washington. Like, I was following a few of these people. One of them was at the University of Arizona, close to where I was, and they got the federal government came to an agreement. I forgot exactly who came to the agreement with these food companies, but they said that they were going to self-regulate and they were going to stop advertising to children. All of the follow-up studies 5 years later show that the advertisements to children didn't change at all. Like, they just continued advertising exactly the same as they were before, just like the agreements that MAHA is coming to with the food companies right now. Like, for example, President Trump recently just said, like, oh, Coke agreed to make Coke with natural sugar. And then a Coca-Cola spokesperson said that they didn't, like, right after. Like, this is exactly what was happening, has always happened, is to appease the population, and they just know people aren't going to continue to pay attention to policy. And if they're actually implementing policy, they know that if they just say something, It'll appease the population. So, I mean, this has always been the case where the government will say, oh, we've made an agreement with, food companies. They're going to do this. And they don't follow through, or it's something that they already were going to do anyway. And so it wasn't a big deal. And so, that's one thing, like advertising to children. That's an easy one that we can shift and improve child nutrition. There's another one that there's many, like taxing sugary beverages. That's another like public health initiative that has evidence to show that it reduces the consumption of sugary beverages and generates tax revenue that could be used to fund,
Who
to subsidize healthier
doesn't,
foods.
I don't want to cut across you, who doesn't want that, right? Who doesn't want us to have regulation on marketing, let's
Food
say ultra
companies.
processed, right. So and who doesn't, so and
Yeah.
who and somewhere along the lines, those people own our government in some way, right? In some way that they are just powerful enough that there's donors involved in in the political process, our election process, that say, hey, I don't want to piss off my donors. This is the people who keep me in power. I mean, is that ultimately what's happening?
Oh yeah, I mean, our government's owned by like seven industries.
Right.
It's always been, I mean, it's like finance, military, food, medicine, or like pharmaceutical, and then oil and gas. Like this, well, now tech. It's probably like six industries. That might cover like who owns our government fully. It's like the major corporations in those industries, and we every once in a while we'll put like a couple of candidates into Washington that are like actually for the people, but the vast majority of senators and people in the House of Representatives are people who had a campaign that was bankrolled by these major companies and major industries, and their campaign was bankrolled by that. They were funded by the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, which is all bankrolled by the same they're all bankrolled by the same companies on both sides, and that's how you get into Washington. And your job in Washington is to just protect the interests of those industries. And this has been like this forever. I mean, it just got worse. And I think it was 2011 when Citizens United was passed, where now you could just donate however, like companies couldn't donate whatever they wanted to political campaigns before that. Once that got passed, like we haven't had a democracy in the least bit since then. Like it's just gotten worse and worse and worse. And yeah, we definitely need to address that at some point, but that requires awareness first.
Is there, like I want to hold you on those two things. So like marketing to children and let's say taxing certain ultra processed foods, let's say. Like it's funny, if you list out some of the things that we just talked about, cuts to Medicaid, cuts to nutrition research, cuts to nutrition assistance programs, you could throw in like mi intentional mistrust in science and vaccines. You could throw the cuts to, I said cuts to Medicaid. We could do this like smoke screen of obsession with ingredients. Like
Also, I mean, so we didn't even go into these things because I wanted to focus on the main three, but there's also been cuts to the CDC and all of the disease surveillance programs that provide us information about measles, the flu, about outbreaks. There's also been cuts to the FDA that monitor food safety, that look at salmonella in chicken, and they actually lifted some of the standards
yeah, the
on
restrictions.
salmonella. There's been cuts to the EPA. In a lot of areas where they're and also they've lifted some of the regulations around PFAS, which are forever chemicals that we know are building up and can have negative effects to our health. They lifted some of the restrictions around asbestos. So like this administration, beyond the three things that we talked about, they've also kind of gutted our Centers for Disease Control, gutted our food, the Food and Drug Administration that's there for safety of our food supply. I mean, these cuts are thousands of jobs. Also, National Park Service, they've cut a lot of jobs from the National Park Service. They're trying to privatize some of that land. So like our food, air, water, medications, every single aspect of our society that we rely on, when it comes to health, is being impacted in a negative way right now. The three things that I've mentioned are the main ones that are going to have like a direct impact on people once they go into place. But these other ones, once the PFAS, for example, like, yeah, that's not going to have a direct impact, but there's a reason those regulations went in place, and now they've been lifted for not good reason. And that's going to have an impact. What's going to happen though is, and ideally, hopefully, if we can vote again in 4 years, we should be able to, but we're going to just have to re-implement all of these restrictions back into place. Like, okay, re-establish the FDA food safety, departments, because the whole departments have been cut in some of these areas, and there's worry among some groups that this may start to impact our food supply at some point, but it's early to really tell.
My hands are sweating again. My point is, like, why are is just are these just perceived inefficiencies and wasted? Is it like perceived waste of money for to have these departments? Is it perceived like extra hoops to jump through to have these regulations on things like PFAS? Like, well, I can't. I'm struggling to see. Okay, like, again, who's winning here? Who's gaining?
So, if we look at like the MAHA movement, and it was, a lot of the people that supported some of this stuff, it was all like, let's make ourselves more like Europe. Europe is so healthy. This is the exact opposite of what Europe does. Europe has so many more regulations than we do. Europe has free health care or universal health care for everyone in every country. We're going in the exact opposite direction. So from a why perspective, like, there's no logical reason around it. Now, from a political, like, speculation about the political reasons behind it, I mean, it's just to create chaos. Like, when you create complete chaos around all that, you just start cutting this, firing these people. People are so distracted by all of that that's going on that you can start to really actually dismantle some of the Constitution and some of the, checks and balances in this country. And so I think these things are just collateral damage for creating chaos. So people will be focusing on the chaos that goes on in all of these various areas, and you can slip through various things that truly break down the checks and balances of our, of our government, that may create a situation where we don't get the opportunity to vote again.
Yeah, and that's a dark thought, but yeah, I see where you're coming from. If we spend, let's say, in 4 years, we are able to right some wrongs, we'll spend a period of time returning to baseline, right? A period of time returning some of these things to baseline. Let's fast forward to a place where we are back at baseline. What would be some things? Either specifics, again, I know you have a public health background, but it's hard for me to sit here and hold you to like a super hyper specific initiative. But even you can get as specific as you want, but from general to specific, things that we should be doing slash focusing on instead.
Yeah, so one of the first things is we have a thing called a farm bill, that this is what makes a lot of the processed foods so low cost, is because it funds the production of corn, wheat, soy, and these commodity crops. Now, this farm bill went into place, I think it was during World War II, and it was designed to ensure that, we had a steady supply of food. After World War II and with industrialization, companies just used all of this surplus food that could be purchased at a low cost to create all of these different processed foods. So that's why all processed foods, for the most part, they're going to be made out of the same things: corn, wheat, soy, soybean oil, canola oil. All of these things are things that are funded by this farm bill. And so one of the first things that we could do to shift the food supply and change the dynamics of the cost of food is to change where some of those subsidies go. So changing the, and this is a problem though, because there's producers of these commodity crops and the companies that buy the commodity crops to create the processed foods that would all be negatively affected by these changes. And so, but that would be number one, is change some of these subsidies in terms of the farm bill. Another,
Can we
thing
stay
is,
on the farm bill really quickly? So I think so essentially we have certain crops here that are subsidized and made cheaper, and that's what allows us to make those foods ultimately really cheap, which is one of the downsides of, let's say ultra processed foods, is they're not just yummy and tasty and, optimized for mouthfeel and all this stuff. They're also very cheap. And so you're saying shift some of those subsidies away from certain monocrops, whatever it is, soy, corn, wheat, whatever. And shift that money towards more nutritious food and making that, bringing the cost of, production for those foods down to make them,
And subsidizing local farms would be amazing. Like, I don't know how possible that is, because there's always logistical, things that need to be considered here. But if you could take that money and use that to create like urban farms outside of most of the major cities in the US or like in major cities in the US, rooftop. You could even spend some of this money to work on new technology to ensure that we could grow food within cities so that we can create local food supplies. Like there's so many different ways. Like if we applied the amount of money and knowledge and resources that we do into creating the bombs that could kill the most amount of people into creating the food that could feed the most amount of people, these problems will be solved in a few years. Like this isn't, these aren't things that are beyond human capacity at this point to be able to do, is to create nutritious local food systems. We just don't, that's not going to happen in a free market economy, because it's not free market anymore. These companies are basically, they're being subsidized to sell you cheap, unhealthy food. Like it's not free market. The cheap, unhealthy food is being paid for by our tax dollars. Like that's not free market at all. And so, those are the things that I think, we have to be thinking about, talking about, and no politician is ever, talking about those things, because you're not, it's going to be very hard to get into office if you're kind of discussing these things that would shift subsidies away from these major food companies.
You have to, yeah. Like I'm gonna again be super reductionist, overly simplify to make a point. But like, if we could do one thing for from a nutrition standpoint, we should increase the difficulty or make nutritious food more accessible and make less nutritious food less accessible. And that could be, changing of the subsidies, could be taxing certain ultra processed foods. It could be fixing food desert problems. It could be
School lunches, trying
school
to like
lunches.
improve
We're
the health
trying
of school
to,
lunches.
yeah, we're trying to make people shift their overall diet intake from ultra processed foods to whole foods. Let's just, if we were going to just put a one single sentence of a thing that would make a huge impact. And to do that is you have like two categories. Like, how can we make people more likely to eat nutritious food? How can we make them less likely to eat ultra processed foods? And let's solve those two problems. Of course, they're very intertwined, but that sounds a lot like what we're trying to do.
Yes. I would say on top of that, I would say that covers most of it. The other side of it is a cultural thing. Like being unhealthy is just culturally acceptable, culturally normal. And I feel like we would have to, like, one of the things that the federal government could do is launch a massive campaign, like billboards, commercials, like just changing what people like. When people think of America out and throughout the world, they think of fat, lazy people. Like, you know how disrespectful that would, like, so people who consider themselves patriotic, if you start to put that message into their mind of like, oh, let's not make America be the land of fat and lazy people, but the land of fit and healthy people, and we start to transmit that message throughout our, from a government standpoint, but that would trickle down to everybody else, and that would have a cultural influence, like, because you could bring in celebrities. Celebrities would do it on their own and start to like promote some of these things. And that, in my opinion, is probably more important than the environment. Like,
You should call it Make America Healthy Again. I feel like that would be
oh yeah,
super,
that would work.
super good slogan, I feel like,
Except actually not doing things that actually matter instead of like
But that's the problem. Hold on.
taking.
Everything you just said, I think people think is happening. So I think that people think that is happening. When we're talking about getting dyes out of Hershey's, we're talking about Coca-Cola switching to that, we're talking about beef tallow in fast food restaurants. I think people think that's happening. And that's a problem in and of itself, where I mean, Make America Healthy Again is happening. That is a thing that exists. These people exist.
Yeah.
It's a powerful slogan, and it's has created all these changes. The problem is we're not picking the things that are going to have a large effect. Like, everything you just said is happening. We have people with huge followings talking about ways to make the country healthier. They're just talking about getting beta carotene in instead of Red 40 in Fruit Loops. They're not talking about the things that will have a large effect. That's all.
Think about how ridiculous and how badly roasted someone would like how badly roasted someone would get if someone went on social media and they were like, I am going to train like someone who is extremely out of shape, unhealthy, and they were like, I'm going to transform my health. Come with me on this journey. I'm going to do it by drinking shakes that don't have Red 40 anymore, but instead have natural coloring. I'm gonna switch out all of my seed oils for tallow, and then I'm gonna start drinking Coke with natural sugar instead of artificial sugar, and I'm gonna avoid titanium dioxide. What would people say if someone posted a video saying they were gonna do that? Like it would you'd be like, what the hell? That's gonna do absolutely nothing for you. You need to be focusing on how much you're eating, the quality of your food, exercise. But when it's a societal perspective, people seem to somehow think that that's like gonna do something. It's not like
I appreciate that point, but I disagree. I think there's a corner of the internet that would say, what if I phrase it this way? I'm going to get all the chemicals out of my food and I'm going to switch back to natural fats. And I think that person is flooded with positivity from an echo chamber of people that think that that's super meaningful. And so I think that it's sad. What you're saying should be true. I just think it's not true. It's like,
I
hey, if
think they'll
I'm.
get flooded by a small percentage of people who are deep into that,
Fair.
but the vast majority of
True.
people will see that on the surface and be able to recognize how pointless that is.
Yeah.
And I don't think that people are able to realize how pointless it is from a societal perspective. I'm not sure what the disconnect there is. And as I'm saying this, I'm like, I feel like I need to make a post, like doing something around this, like trying to shift that perspective of like, if you were obese, unhealthy, unfit, and you were trying to get healthy, would you cut artificial sweeteners out, or whatever, the MAHA things? It's like, so why do we think that this is actually going to help from a societal perspective? It's not. Our country is in very poor health, and we need actual things that are going to move the needle, and that's not it.
If you put your most optimistic hat on, what are like the error bars, the positive outlook and the negative outlook? Let's do the positive outlook. Is a positive outlook like hold on for dear life and hopefully re-vote and hopefully the people have woken up to, maybe these aren't the best things that are happening, and spend a serious amount of lost time undoing some of this stuff, but maybe have ultimately learned from it. Is that the most positive outlook?
I believe so, and I think that's gonna be a concerted effort. That's gonna require a lot of our population kind of joining in and like helping with that effort. Not, how people say, "Oh, don't be political." Like, I think that just has to be more of the case for us to pull ourselves out of this current situation. Like, people have to talk about politics more. You can't just be in the room believing bullshit and like going and voting now and never having a conversation about it, and then. Because every time I have a conversation with someone, around some of these things, I hear, "Oh, I voted this because of this," and it's like, that's not true at all. Like, the fact that you're not having conversations with other people around you is causing you to create all of these completely negative ideas or like misleading ideas and holding on to them. The same thing, you get stuck in the echo chamber with nutrition and wellness as well, and it's like. Because it's a taboo thing that we don't talk about, it's easy for people to get pulled into these echo chambers and not have conversations with friends and family that would prevent that as much. And I feel like just societally, people have always said, you don't talk about politics, and I just, in my opinion, I think that's a weird way to go. Like, it influences every aspect of our life. Why would we not discuss, this isn't an only American thing. And I feel like maybe this is, I also feel like this might have been intentional, political power, powerful political, people were intentionally wanting people not to talk about politics in the United States, because this is not the case elsewhere from what I understand. Like, people that I know from other countries are like, "Oh, that's strange," when I've mentioned this. And I think that that's we just need to be able to have these discussions more, and not, because this isn't me versus you. This is how our society is being governed. And two, we've I feel like we've been programmed from a young age to pick a side and then want to be the winner. And we're all losing right now. Like, everyone's like, most of us are losing, like, in terms of our society. We're continuing to rack up debt, and we do not have, like, in the United States, we have the largest economy, but quality of life, access to healthcare, life expectancy, we rank low on most important outcomes that people would be paying attention to outside of GDP. And so, I think it's just time that we need to start having these discussions more so that we can move forward in a more unified way.
Do you think that's happening at all? Because I agree with you 100% that like that's almost a cultural understanding of hey, you don't talk about politics at work. You don't talk about politics like at out to dinner or like basically a very small subset of times in your life where it's culturally okay and acceptable to talk about politics. And I think that undoing that and talking more is important. Do you think that's happening, or is it happening in our nutrition, public health? I bubble more, but not necessarily happening more, or do you think it is happening more, and that's probably a good thing?
I think it's happening a little bit more, and that will continue as these current policies start to impact people's lives more. I think it's a great thing. I just don't think that people are well equipped enough to have these conversations. I feel like a large percentage of people, I mean, and it's not a bad thing. I mean, I understand not wanting to pay attention to these things, but if you're not actually looking at policy and seeing the policy that's going through and understanding like those, like we were just talking about, like the 40% cuts to the NIH, like actually looking at the things that are written down and being passed through law, I think sometimes you're operating from a very twisted mentality because the media is just insane right now. One media source is going to twist it one way, and one media source is going to twist it another way. And I just try to find the bills and read them as best as I can. And like, and I think it's difficult because you have to invest the time and energy into it. And having those conversations without investing the time and energy usually ends up being an emotionally driven conversation without much substance. And so, yes, I want those conversations to happen more frequently, but I also think in order for them to be productive, there needs to be a higher investment from each person on a population level in terms of like really learning what's going on in our government. And one of the things that I always like in America, or in the United States, the number of hours that people watch or people spend watching football or sports and reality TV and those things, like that's probably 100x what people spend on like understanding our
Current
government
events, yeah.
and the political candidates that you're voting for. And like that, we can't have a democratic society if that's the case. Like it requires people to be informed about what they're voting for. Otherwise, we're going to see what we have seen, where those who have resources to get into power do that, and then they manipulate the way our government works in order to benefit them and their friends as much as possible.
Yeah, I've been blissfully ignorant for the first probably 30 years of my life, and I think that you, like you said, you don't just need our population. You need a subset of that population who don't feel they are affected, to feel affected, right? To somehow have that empathy of for those that are will be more affected, and that's challenging. And if you wait for those people, because we will all be affected by these things in some way or another, if you wait for that effect to take place to then change your mind, like it'll be too late. And so yeah, it's a challenging thing to get someone to care about something like, people have day-to-day problems, and so unless you're like face-to-face confronted with this problem, which I think most people are, but maybe don't recognize or aren't, that is a challenging thing to do. But I agree with you. I think a cultural shift to talking about it more. And my family are from the Netherlands, and there's been some weird things happening in the Dutch government. And you're right. We talk about it more. So, it's like not as weird to it's not even weird to like
Yeah,
argue
it's not a
about
weird
it.
thing to do. It's like, oh, this is what's going on. I don't support it. Well, I kind of do. Here's why. And then you can come to a resolution of like, oh, your side makes sense and my side makes sense. And now I have a better understanding. Whereas I think that's what created some of this polarization is like you get an idea of who these other people are because you never talk to people and know what their political beliefs are. And you're like, oh, that's actually my friend believes this thing. And you didn't know that. And you could have a conversation and like learn more about, people in that way. But yeah, I've always been one to have these conversations, but I know that a lot of people get uncomfortable with them.
Is there anything else? I don't want to hold you too long here. It's been super helpful. I want there to be a resource where people can just get a lay of the land, a state of affairs. And I think we've done that really well. Is there any point on the positive of what we should be doing, things that we could focus on that you want to make versus, or something on the negative that maybe we brushed over that you think deserves a double click?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've people are doing, you know, people, as we talked about, people are paying attention more, and I think that's a great thing. And the MAHA having people paying more attention to health, I think over the next several years, it's just a matter of people stepping up and taking a leadership role and trying to, you know, be a leader in this new environment that, because there's gonna need to be a bridge between what's going on now and like getting to a society where things are more equitable. And I think that's gonna take a completely different set of people who we'd look to towards for political information. Like, it's not gonna be traditional politicians anymore. Like, I think average people are gonna need to step up and take these, you know, run for House, run for Senate, and all. I think that's where we can see a positive future. And I've seen a lot of people doing that around me too. Like, a lot of the, you know, seats in Texas and around the country are like just, you know, some physician who got passionate about, you know, what's going on and now is running for Senate and running for House. And I think, you know, what we can do is try to find those people and support them who are like genuine, care about the population, and they are doing this more as a public service as opposed to these career politicians that have been there forever and have created this state of affairs.
Do you have any interest in being involved in some way?
Probably not. I mean, I would at some point, but yeah, it depends. I'm it would definitely have to be the right circumstances.
It's that's a tricky situation. Of course, you'd be somebody that I think would do a great job. And I don't even know in what, but like somebody who would have the country's health at as the primary thing that you'd be focused on and not some sort of ulterior motive.
Yeah, definitely appreciate that.
Cool, man. Anything else we want to say before we get out of here?
No, I think we covered a lot.
I appreciate you coming on. I don't think we did. I think we did it. I think we did it justice, of keeping it factual and talking about the things that would really help and not just being outraged. Because I think that could have happened. My hands were sweating quite a bit, and there were a couple. I was taking some notes in the background, and I was like, I don't know if you heard me typing, but I was like slamming away on the keyboard, and then I was like, maybe don't do that. Yeah, I was like, maybe don't do that rant.
Yeah, I have to hold myself back quite often as well. I mean, I just don't know where we're gonna be in 3 years. That's what kind of worries me, and that's why I feel like I've always been extremely like in, like I've always spent quite a bit of time like learn like I look at all the candidates. I spent a lot of time reading and learning about politics. I never really talk about it that much in a public setting, but I have recently, just because of, and I wouldn't even call it politics. Like, this isn't politics. This is what the government is doing, essentially. And I've always paid attention to that. I've tried not to talk about it as much, but yeah, definitely. It's just necessary nowadays. It's just more needed to have more voices that aren't pulling people to one's extreme side or the other.
Yeah, that's another fear of like a equal but opposite recoil to an alternative extreme. That's certainly a possible outcome for sure. All right, do the podcast thing. You know, where can people find you? Drop your business. Do some marketing. Make this worth your while for coming on today.
All right. So if you want, I have a podcast called the Nutrition Science Podcast that I cover a variety of different topics, mostly not about this, mostly about different topics around nutrition. So definitely recommend checking that out. And if you want to, you can go follow me at Instagram at Dr. Adrian Chavez. You'll put a period. So it's DR period. Adrian period Chavez, and you can find all of the links to different resources and things that I offer there.
Cool. Thanks for coming on, man. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram, @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.